713-526-4000. Again, that's 713-526-4000. Please join listeners like you in helping to ensure that the independent voice of KPFT will be preserved for generations to come. Name KPFT as a beneficiary in your will today. This is KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Up next, Technology Bites.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to tonight's edition of Technology Bites.
It is indeed time for Technology Bites. Welcome to the show. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
And I'm Barrett.
Yeah, we're in a double missing geek formation tonight. Lee had other obligations and I don't know what's up with Groovehouse.
Did he come back?
He
I came back.
He wasn't saying he was still sick.
Who, Lee?
Yeah, Lee. That worked for him for a couple of weeks, right?
No, now he's got like some kind of story he has to write for this air quote newspaper. Or
oh, well, that's cool. It's probably about being sick and then missing shows and going seeing missing shows.
Technology Bites flounders with absence of co-host. Breaking news. Or something.
Last 3 weeks, that show's really gone downhill. I don't know what it is.
Or maybe it's gone uphill. You know, the one show he wasn't here was the show that we shined in the fundraiser.
Yeah, but I wasn't here either. And then when I came back, we didn't. So maybe it's me.
It's both.
Yeah, maybe it's a combo.
Maybe we got to get rid of more than one person. I see. Perhaps the RIF was not deep enough. All right, we got to make sure that all the investors in the show get, you know, a good return on their investment. So we got to cut costs. I think we could slash our budget pretty readily by getting rid of some more people that don't get paid. All right, well, welcome to the show. We're glad you could tune in with to the four of us. It'll be great. It's always better when people are missing because we can laugh at them and have fun at their expense like they do when I leave. So
is Groove still on holiday?
I thought he was flying back, but, you know, who knows?
We shall check the internets.
I think he's ditching it all and living on a beach somewhere forever.
He's going to stay in Hawaii.
Be tough to leave. I could see that.
I don't know. It's a
genius pictures.
It's pretty, but it's geriatric. I don't know if I could stay in there. And then, plus, it's expensive. It's not like Groove House is making a ton of money, you know, not getting paid to be on the radio and all. All right. Visit us online at geekradio.com. I think I've fixed the problem again with the podcast. So hopefully if you're listening to this on a podcast, you're witnessing the success of my efforts to make that work again, to make Geek Radio great again. And you can learn about the podcast, see announcements for upcoming events such as the Geek Gatherings, and also use the contact form to send us a message. Did you get your hair cut?
No, Barrett? I just took off my hat. Okay. Well, I got it cut before I left last week. Yeah, I guess I did, since the last time I've seen you.
You did get a
Thanks
lot of
for noticing,
you
Jay.
Did get a lot of sun, didn't you? So
how did your trip go?
Yeah, Barrett's back from hacking in Costa Rica.
Yeah, that was not sunburn. That was red jungle dust.
No, your hair looks lighter.
Oh, did you get the Zika virus? Your head.
I didn't know about that before I went down. Otherwise, I would have worn a lot more insect repellent while I was getting bitten on the beach. Yeah, no one ever said Zika.
Really? You were like just completely off your radar heading to a Zika-infested nation.
No, someone might have mentioned that, but also Tika was being thrown around, and Tico. Tika, I think, is a female from Costa Rica, or Tico, gentleman from
Costa
Rica.
You could get Zika from a Tika.
Probably. I knew none of this. I didn't read the pamphlets.
Well,
and since when has the State Department said anything that would be of importance to you, right?
I don't want to. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to put you in quarantine, so.
I should be okay. It's amazing I came back. I just given, you know, my general ability to navigate and stuff. There's not a safety first attitude there. Like, for instance, you know, in the city just around the office where we were, uncovered manholes, you know, like the storm drains where, you know, where we've got covers. No, just, you know, watch your step. Kind of a thing. I'm like, oh, it's just a foot or two deep. No, it's the real deal. Yeah.
So it's surprising you're not dead.
Someone we know from DEF CON, actually, when I was on the flight out or on the way getting driven to the airport to fly out, got mugged outside of their office. So it's because they were telling us to be very cautious, you know, and I think maybe where the office was located. We kind of had like a quote-unquote handler getting us around town. And yeah, so he was always like, hey, Barrett, don't go over there. Hey, stay close. You stay in the car, lock the doors. Don't do this, don't do that. And then I was like, okay, maybe this is, you know, I don't know if it's like awesome or motherly or what. And then, yeah, we were going out, and Laszlo, a guy we know from DEF CON, was held up right, like, I think within a block of the office doors there.
Wow.
I want to say in broad daylight, but it's pretty bright out there. It was daylight, you know, it's like 2 in the afternoon. So
wow.
Go figure. I never really thought Brazil was safe before, but yeah, this is.
Wait, I thought you were in Costa Rica.
I was in Costa Rica, but I used to say that Brazil was sketchy, because I worked down there for a while. Now I think Brazil's my safe place.
I see. All right, so so the website, and also we hang out on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com, cuckoo. And,
we miss Groove House.
I know, we miss
He had jumbo legroom 20 hours ago.
I know, he's,
so
I know he's back.
So save the internets.
Maybe he...
Too much legroom, maybe. You know, you get... too stretched out. It's kind of hard to do a radio show after.
He's has jet lag.
His travel partner just wondered why he was sitting in there, sitting next to her, and said, cuckoo. She thinks he's sick now.
He is sick. All right. So, yeah. So, irc.cuckoo.com and the channel Tech Bites, if you want to hang out with us. We're on the IRC, the show within a show, as we call
it. See, it might depend on if she was speaking when he said that, what might have happened.
Ooh, I love you. Cuckoo. We're going to get in trouble for talking about Groove House again.
Or worse. And are you listening to me?
Are you listening to us? Hi, Groove.
We're in for it now.
Yeah.
All right, well...
That's why you don't miss the show.
It's fine. I know. I've learned that lesson. Thanks for that, Jay. Yeah. So, all right. Well, you know, at least it's getting cold outside again. That's kind of nice that we got a little cold weather coming in.
You think it's the final hurrah?
A little
hard,
piece of not
it's hard
summer.
To say, but maybe.
I mean, it's.
I mean, 80 degrees March, over the week. Was it over the weekend or like earlier this last week?
It was last. It was a few days ago.
Good Lord.
Have we had a hard freeze in Houston yet?
No, not yet.
No.
So we're going to have killer mosquitoes come spring and summer. Zika. It was not me. It was the lack of a hard freeze.
We're not going to know where it came from, but we're going to blame you.
I was not a vector.
Patient zero. So, so that's all this information that we have to give out. And with the reduced number of hosts tonight, the banter at the beginning it now draws to a close. And we will, and we were worried, weren't we, that the internet wasn't working, but apparently it is working.
Pete's yeah, so on. Far it's been, I got on a little bit early and, you know, because if I can hear what's on the air on KPFT through the connection, then I know I'm good, you know, then it's works. So I listened to a bit of Saeed and it's been solid for 20 minutes now.
Pete's been radicalized. All right, so we will now bring you the Al Jazeera of tech news with Peter Hughes InfoShot. Take it away, InfoShot.
It's the Technology Bites InfoShot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes, injected directly into your skull.
And I think we'll try, you know, I think we should try the what we did while we were in the Three Geek formation last week, and maybe just we can talk about each story right after it and see how that works as we add more people in. Maybe it'll be the new way to do stuff. So then you can't just sit there and ignore and just do other things and surf the web while I do the news. this was interesting. There's the whole Apple FBI story going on, but there's another aspect to it that I had only seen in passing. On Friday, an Apple executive explicitly confirmed what was stated in a government court filing earlier last Friday, that in the early hours of the San Bernardino terrorism investigation, county officials may have inadvertently compromised their own ability to access the data on the seized iPhone 5C. You know, there's that whole thing with the court order to create custom firmware where Apple was ordered to create custom firmware for the iPhone 5C that was used by Syed Rizwan Farooq in the San Bernardino shooting thing. That new firmware would remove a possible automatic wipe feature on the phone if you put the password incorrectly in 10 times. And it would remove a delay between passcode attempts that's supposed to make the brute force approach more difficult. You know, essentially the idea is that Apple takes those limits off, and then the FBI would be able to brute force the passcode attempts until they got the right one. You know, they could enter them very quickly. You know, they can hook up hardware that would enter them very quickly and so on. Apple CEO Tim Cook has publicly said it will resist this attempt, calling it a significant overreach, and there will be a court hearing March 22nd. So we'll hear from that. But the thing that during the Friday call, the unnamed Apple executive said the company has been diligently working with the FBI to try and aid the investigation. After days of working with the FBI, Apple proposed one final attempt to recover roughly six weeks of data that was locked on the phone. The idea was to force the iPhone 5C to auto backup to Farooq's iCloud account. With a legal court order, Apple can and does turn over iCloud data. For some reason, Farooq had not backed up the phone for roughly 6 weeks prior to the attack. Really, a user not backing up? How could that happen? And especially when he's planning a terrorist act? Anyway, the executive said Apple does not know whether the auto backup was disabled or enabled, but he did say that the previous iCloud backups, which were handed over to investigators, were sporadic. Apple suggested that the FBI take the iPhone 5C, plug it into a wall, connect it to a known Wi-Fi network, and leave it overnight. The FBI took the phone to the San Bernardino County Health Department, where Farooq worked. And when that attempt did not work, Apple was mystified, but soon found out that the Apple ID account password had been changed shortly after the phone got in the custody of law enforcement, possibly by someone from the county health department. With no way to enter the new password on the locked phone, even attempting an auto backup. So basically what happened is they went and changed the Apple ID password. And so now the password that's on the phone when it tries to connect to iCloud is whatever his original one was, and the new one, you have to get into the phone to enter the new one to make it back up and do stuff correctly. And there's an update at the end of this story. It says that that San Bernardino County tweeted Friday evening that, in fact, the password was reset at the FBI's request. It's like, oops, somebody at the FBI needs to maybe think about talking to experts before they start changing iCloud passwords. So that's part of why this has kind of gone up to where it is now with the kind of the standoff between Apple and the FBI. It's a little different. Frankly, it seems to me like the FBI leaving out the fact that they messed up, that there was a perfectly legal and normal way that they could have done this where it would have likely worked, and the FBI screwed up, and now Apple has to go to heroic lengths. I think it does undercuts the FBI's argument when they screw up and then want special extra treatment because to fix their thing. So,
well, there was a I think it might be tonight, or one of the ABC news anchors is doing an interview with Tim Cook, and they did a preview of the interview on World News Tonight on ABC 13. Where he was talking to Tim Cook and talked about, he actually asked the question of Tim Cook. He says, why couldn't y'all have like worked with the FBI? You know, he talked about how Apple always shrouds everything in secrecy and all of the releases up until, he says, why didn't you go like into a back room with the FBI and just work on this one thing? And Tim Cook pointed out that it really was the FBI who brought this out into the public, this whole, we want to do this to the phone kind of thing, and brought it to the public attention that this was even going on. And Tim Cook expressed that he was not really certain why the FBI decided to make this whole thing public.
Maybe to get some precedence for it or to try and get in. It's weird to see how the teams are kind of emerging on this. I know it's made for some pretty strange bedfellows. Like John McAfee and Bill Gates are both on the pro unlocking side, which I wouldn't have thought Gates would have been. And then it wasn't Edward Snowden.
I've seen it sort of portrayed both ways on Gates, and
he came out yesterday and came out and said, hey, he's pro unlocking. He agrees. Which is weird. But then the victim's family said that they're
misquoted, but I haven't read deeper on it
I wonder what, like, I don't know if it has to do with the chain of evidence or whatever, but it seems at least feasible that couldn't Apple take possession of the phone, do whatever they need to do to break into it, get the data, and just give the data to the FBI? I mean, it's not unheard of for telecommunications and electronics people to provide data that they can get access to, whether it's IP records or phone records of someone with a subpoena for that one time. I mean, but Tim Cook in his interview also talked about the idea of writing this software that they would need to do this is abhorrent to them. But just the idea of writing software to backward engineer the security of their own devices is not a software that they want to develop.
But there were also some commentary that said that they believe that, and this may have been EFF, I don't remember where I read this, but that they believe that the government, the FBI, is hoping to use this particular case, which is, built on a horrific, scenario, to help get it through to set legal precedents for doing this kind of stuff in a legal system in the future. But the thing is, so even if Apple didn't give it to them, if they just did it themselves, then it sets precedents for the government to say, we submitted this to the courts and Apple obeyed us. The courts agreed and Apple obeyed us. And so now in the future, we can do the same thing. But the thing is, that opens the door for, anybody else, Syria to do that, or, Egypt or North Korea or China or whoever, anybody.
Some guy in Vegas, yeah, at a convention somewhere. Gates, so Gates talked to the Financial Times yesterday, and his argument was to unlock all phones and hand over all information. He just said, you know, it's, quote, this is a specific case where the government is asking for access to information. They're not asking for some general thing. They're asking for a very particular case. So his argument was do it this one time, but like Flicted says, I think that no one should do it. Just it does set a really dangerous precedent.
Well, and here's this next story kind of dovetails in nicely. Apparently, as this is all happening, it's been revealed that there are 12 other encrypted iPhones that the Department of Justice is trying to use the same precedent. It's an 18th century law called the All Writs Act that they're using. So it's from the 1700s that they're using, that they've leveraged into, that it means that Apple has to provide this backdoor. So, you know, they've already got 12 other phones on deck if they can get this one case through, then obviously they can go through the rest. So that does undercut, you know, Bill Gates, obviously all he knows is what he knows about it, you know, and he knows what the reporter asks, and so it would be interesting to hear what he had to say with this kind of, because this is systematic and patterned. Then, you know, Apple has cited that what creating a quote government ordered backdoor is that it is basically technically possible, although Tim Cook is likened this to opening a Pandora's box, stating that the backdoor could fall into the wrong hands and be impossible to unmake in the long run. So we'll see what develops there. But yeah, there's other, and it's not terrorism. So I think, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it does kind of make sense that the FBI would pick their most visible terrorism, you know, because they love the ticking time bomb example. You know, could this prevent a terrorist attack? Is the magic key to open every door and eliminate all opposition to a security thing.
Hey, Pete, yeah. did you see the New York Times piece that said that it's rumored that Apple may be working on a phone that's unbreakable? And mainly, I don't think it's a hardware solution. I think they're trying to upgrade the security measures to where it's just you cannot get into it.
One of the things is on older phones, Apple stopped storing the encryption keys for the devices running iOS 8 or later. So basically, they stopped keeping the keys that they could use for that. You know, made it basically a stronger, where they can't, because obviously if they don't have the key, then they're out. But I saw there was an article. I almost put it in, but. There was other stuff about them making a phone that even they can't break, which
so
is kind of cool.
You're good on that, though. Do you think that's more rumor, or do you think there's some truth to that? Like, what's your take?
I could see where, you know, essentially if they build something that it's just, you know, essentially if the government wants to come in and order a backdoor, and right now it's possible and plausible that it is technically possible, if you do it in a way that isn't. You know, I'll use a really like low end example. You know, it used to be that passwords on a lot of systems were stored in plain text. And then when somebody came up with the one way hash, it meant that the passwords, you know, even if you got into the database and looked at it, you couldn't tell what the password was. Now, there's issues. Anybody who wants to read up on it, there's issues with MD5 and that kind of stuff where it's you can brute force it and there's enough horsepower and so on. But that evolution, that change from, oh, well, we just store the password, you know, plain text, and now then they change it to where they hash it. And even knowing that it's a one-way hash, it's not like you can just take the result and then decrypt it. The only way is to hash something and compare it, which is a much more, you know, takes a lot more brute force to make that work. And I think Apple's probably looking at doing sort of the same kind of step forward. If it's possible to do and they do it, it's kind of hard to say, well, should, you know, then you get to a more difficult thing. Should that be illegal to be able to do?
I'd be able to make an unbreakable phone.
Right. It's kind of a, yeah. It's one of those where I don't think that, I don't know that that would pass constitutional muster.
Although from a business standpoint, I think that's got to be costly for them to, you know, have to go back and forth with high priced attorneys to have to, you know, go into, you know, the great length that Jay mentioned, you know, if they were supposed to go in and, you know, create a whole program to do what they want to do. But even if it just becomes, you know, course of matter of the day, surely they've got to pay a few staffers to handle those requests. Wouldn't it be cheaper to say, hey, we don't do it and actually don't do it, make it impossible to store?
Right. And I think that may be part of why they're doing it. You know,
stay
why
the
they're
news,
taking that approach.
Yeah, stay out of the controversy. Stay out of everything.
Yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, we can't. Nobody can get into this. So too bad. You know, I'm sorry, we can't. You know, it's like if you make the safe, the unbreakable safe, it's kind of, well, you know, if it's unbreakable and you forgot the combination, well, what can we do for you? We can't do anything, you know, because you could feasibly, I guess, lock something physically up to a degree that, you know, the law enforcement couldn't get to it. And if they can't get to it, they can't use it. I mean, it gets into where you start getting accused of being pro-criminal. But the thing that, you know, the clear thing on the backdoor deal is, if there's a back door, that's wide open for other people to get into your stuff. You know, it's like if there was a magic wall on your house that if you punched in the right code, you could see into every room of your house from outside. But only law enforcement's going to use it. And, you know, of course, they're not going to do it when your, I don't know, your lovely girlfriend or your teenage daughter or yourself or whatever are doing something that you would not prefer to have publicly viewable, that some hacker comes by and does it. You know, I guess that the you're pro-criminal if you say you want to have encryption, pro-terrorism. The flip side is there's no obligation for any of us to do things to make law enforcement's job, to do their job for them on ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not required to go like turn ourselves in if we commit a crime. Oh, officer, I jaywalked. Please.
Self-arrest. I need to come full circle. I think that the real point of this whole story is that if you're not backing up your data, you're a terrorist.
Well, if you're a terrorist, yeah, you should back it up to iTunes and not iCloud.
6 weeks of not backing up could be a terrorist. Better back up, people.
Sounds like more like a normal user. He may be amongst the elite who have something resembling a backup of their phone. I don't, you know, some of it is, to me, the data is pretty ephemeral. I'm not really concerned about the stuff that I would want to restore to a phone, you know, that I take with me from phone to phone as I move along. Doesn't change that much. So I have, you know, I use iTunes. You know, if I get a new iPhone, I plug it into iTunes and it puts in my contacts and all my, you know, my stuff. Obviously, the best way to do it is you put your old phone on, back it up, and then plug your new phone in. But I don't know about you guys. Is there stuff that really changes that much on your phone that you would be, that if you lost everything that was on there right now, that you would be kind of in trouble for missing stuff or for not having data?
Photos, but I mean, most of my photos I've got, they back up to, you know, various services whenever I'm on Wi-Fi and plugged in. So that just kind of self-backs itself up. But, you know, nothing sensitive. No, all my sensitive information isn't kept on the phone, or it's, you know, kept somewhere else.
Yeah, that, I guess that's the other piece. If Apple makes an operating system that can't be, you know, where it's secure and private, is how do they deal with, you know, the cloud part? Obviously, is not and wouldn't be. I don't think they could build. Once you start passing it around the network, it starts. I don't know that there's a way to do that where it would be, you know. Because if you want to be able to share your stuff and that, then
you can't have it both ways. Yeah, you can't have it completely private and be able to share it. It's not with the technology that we've got right now. I'm just kind of, you know, I really dig the, you know, they can't get into your phone argument. But at the same time, you know, we used to have wallets. I've got an actual physical wallet, and they can't see what's in my wallet right now. Whereas, you know, they can kind of, the argument is they should be able to see what's in everyone's phones without, you know, doing anything. So
yeah,
but
you just went through the airport. Although, you know, I guess they're not using the X-ray, the naked scanners that they used to use.
I still got one of those. It looked the same. It looked like the back scatter where you put your arms up, so the thing spins around.
Yeah, where you go in and put your hands up like you're surrendering.
Yeah, as of just a week ago. Yeah, sure enough. I'm so irradiated by now, I don't really care. I used to do the opt-out thing, but not when I'm late.
All right. Well, yeah, I don't know. There's the tough thing to me is that there's a lot of what goes on with security is hidden. And to some extent that makes sense, but it also means that we as, you know, citizens don't have enough information to really form a full opinion. Mm-hmm. I would really like to know how many terrorist acts have been prevented by the various techniques, you know, the inconveniences that we go through, taking off our shoes and I mean actually caught. So you took your shoes off and they figured out that somebody had bombs in their shoes, or that you got in the back scatter and they saw that you had, you know, I don't know, an arsenal strapped under your vest or whatever. Because I wonder about those numbers. You know, there's always the news stories where somebody sneaks something big through there, you know, a reporter or a test thing. So you know there's some of that, but then there's also, you know, okay, how often is this really working? And can we trust the results they give us? Because there'd be a point where you can make a decision. If the deals were searching for the one in a million, human nature would be that the odds are you'll miss it. If it's that subtle, then all it takes is, you know, somebody, you know, sneezing at the wrong time when the person steps in the back scatter or whatever, you know, and you miss it. And then boom, there's the successful whatever attack or whatever they're trying to do. But, you know, without any numbers or any metrics, it's kind of hard to, you know, all we get is this stuff. You know, Comey, the head of the FBI, is he the one that had the AOL account that somebody hacked? You know, you kind of, it's sort of like, okay, this guy, you know, presumably he's got a big staff of people who are smarter than us or surrounding him that try to make his stuff secret. And so if he's casual about how our stuff shouldn't be secret, I don't know. Anyway, certainly this will be a conversation that we'll be having variations on for, I don't know, as long as the show runs, because I don't think there'll ever be an end to the two sides of it.
Well, this coming on the heels of all the talk about, you know, trying to criminalize encryption and stuff. So it's bad timing for the government to be wanting to break into a phone, I think.
Yeah. Well, so I guess maybe they're going to try to make it an either or. It's like, well, legalize weed if you can't have legal encryption.
So if the FBI starts bargaining. Look, if you help us make everyone give up their security, we'll decriminalize heroin.
Free ponies for everybody.
We'll support gay rights, Tim Cook. We won't persecute you. I don't know. All right, what next? Is there another story? Uh-oh. It's right about that time.
Yeah, I wondered. I couldn't tell if you guys cut off or if it was.
At least, yeah. It's usually you. just from the listener's perspective. It's not you, Pete. It's us. Uh-oh, I jinxed that.
He's gone.
Pete. Come back.
You know, it's weird because it's always right about. There he is. Okay, he just came back.
Oh, okay, so now it's doing the flaky thing.
It's every time it happens, it's right at the 8:30 mark. Right around that time. That's very strange.
I'm going to start timing it very precisely from when he connects to when it actually cuts out. I bet it's within a minute or so.
Did he go again? I guess we are having the flaky internet again. Flaky internet. All right. So, gosh, we lost Pete. I love technology.
We talk too long about what the government should and should not do.
Apparently, we can't break Pete out of his own internet. There he is.
I Barrett started talking and then disappeared, and so I was just waiting for when I heard you guys again. I think there must be some kind of job running. There's got to be something because it is always at the same time.
It's a or either that or the denial of service attack comes 30 minutes into the show. Oh crap, it's time.
Lazy hackers. Yeah.
Maybe we have to figure out the 8:30 segment that we, you know, just
moment of silence at
maybe
every bottom of the hour.
Maybe they just have a cron job.
Yeah.
Kicks off at the same time.
So hopefully now I'm back for the rest of the show, because that's usually what happens.
That's usually what happens, all right.
In February 2014, thousands of Asus router owners found a disturbing text file saved to their devices. It said, quote, "This is an automated message being sent to everyone affected. Your Asus router and your documents can be accessed by anyone in the world with an internet connection." The anonymous sender then urged the readers to visit a site that explained more about the vulnerability. On Tuesday, the Federal Trade Commission settled charges that alleged the hardware manufacturer failed to protect consumers as required by federal law. The settlement resolves a complaint that said the 2014 mass compromise was the result of vulnerabilities that allowed attackers to remotely log into routers and, depending on user configurations, change security settings or access files stored on connected devices. Under the agreement, Asus is going to maintain a comprehensive security program subject to independent audits for the next 20 years. And the article goes on to say this should serve as a wake-up call, not just for other router makers, but the whole Internet of Things. Because this kind of stuff, people, you know, some stuff there, if it's compromised, they don't really care that much. But when you start getting into your baby monitor and stuff that's securing your home, climate control and those types of things. There was just a I don't have the full article on it, and you can get all the articles we're talking about tonight are at geekradio.com, or links to them. Somebody has hacked the climate control in a Nissan Leaf electric car, and they did it. They were the person doing the hacking was in Europe, and the person in the car was in the United States. So long distance hack where they compromised apparently was only the climate control system on this Nissan Leaf.
Was that by choice, or was that's all they could get into?
That was all they could do right now. You know, it's one of those where that is in the door. It's kind of like the burglar that can, if they can get into part of your house, then there's certainly more. There's more opportunity for them to get into the rest. So apparently on the Asus router, their password protection was often easy to bypass, either by supplying a vulnerable router with a special URL that was supposed to be accessed only after credentials were entered, so that's just bad coding, or by exploiting cross-site forgery or cross-site scripting vulnerabilities. FTC attorneys also challenged password advice provided in Asus manuals, which in one case suggested users secure files accessible on a router with the username of family and an identical password. That's a great way to set yourself up is, yeah, we're really concerned about security. Yeah, why don't you just the username family, password family. That's really up there with password. So, this is a cool part. The FTC complaint said Asus failed to perform penetration tests on its products to test if they were vulnerable to common attacks on the internet. And so obviously with Asus getting hit with this, you hope that more companies are going to look at doing penetration tests and making sure their stuff is really secure. You know, there's a lot of script kiddies that I think they could get employment getting them to do these tests. I guess part of it is you got to get where you know that you can trust them enough that they'll tell you when they find something and not just share it. But
tough part with the Internet of Things, I think some of the selling point is that everything is going to be or supposed to be pretty inexpensive. You know, it's so it's not the Internet of Things or the digital divide. So how many companies, you know, like a $5 product or an $8 product are going to be able to put in $20 of security? You know, that's what I'm worried about. I think there's going to be a lot of things that are going to hit that are cheap. They're are not going to be thinking about security, and they're just going to be out there for, you know, all time.
Yeah, well, they need to, you know, it's one of those things where they should be ponying up. You know, I know the other side of it is consumers. Mm-hmm. If you make it where you have to set a special password, you know, where you have to do 10 more steps to set up your the light bulb that you want to be able to turn on remotely. If you add more steps where it's like, okay, choose a username and password. Make sure your password has some non-alphabetic kind of thing. I think that nobody's come up with the how do you secure this stuff where, without human intervention, where you can plug and play it and it's still secure for accessing that. And I think that the deal is, though, the pressure needs to be kept on, because otherwise they're going to say, yeah, well, I want to sell this for 20 cents a unit and I'm not going to put any. So I'm putting in username user and password is password on the device. And once you have the IP and you put those in, ding, you're in. Hmm. It's just sort of there must be some way to make it where the communication, if these are these devices are communicating. Mm-hmm. So they need to be that, that communication needs to be secure somehow.
I think it needs to be secure standards. I mean, that's the thing. So instead of leaving it up to each of these individual makers of things to come up with their own, in-house answers to security issues, we need, and this is really tough, but if we could come up with some, very solid, very secure, IoT protocols, that might be a little bit of the solution. But, the protocols usually race far, far, far behind, the companies trying to get product out the door, and they're just kind of making things up.
Yeah, well, and we've talked about it. It is sort of the history of kind of geek technology. Is the beginning is like, hey, we can go on this internet thing and communicate with anybody, anybody else who's hooked up to it. And so literally you could sit down at, you could sit down at a console somewhere. And if a person you knew of, maybe somebody who's sort of famous or whatever was online at the same time, you could send them messages just directly, let alone the whole kind of store and forward. The reason, the email system isn't secure is because nobody thought about the idea that, why would you fake your stuff? You just want to send a message to, Fred over in the other building. Nobody would want to fake who they were from, who it was from, or send it to everybody, the spam thing.
I think it's one of those situations where you're like, hey, let's throw a party. I hope no bad people show up. back in the day, it was a whole bunch of MIT, computer geeks. And yeah, there weren't any bad people at all. But I think now it's become so ubiquitous that, a couple bad people are going to wander into the party and we've got to lock down everything.
So the whole jocks versus nerds thing continues.
The Beastie Boys called it 20 years ago.
Well, and then here's another one. Dan Kaminsky is a master of all that is terrible and wonderful about the Internet's domain name service, a vital piece of Internet infrastructure dating back to 1983. So obviously I'm sure they were very sophisticated about networking and coding in 1983. Its criticality and age make it a source of ongoing problems in Internet security. The most recent DNS, just in case, there may be two of you out there who don't listen or who haven't come across this enough. Basically DNS maps between the names. So when you go to whatever.com, the actual address is a number.
Domain name system.
Yeah, and so it maps it. It would be kind of the equivalent is kind of like if there was a way where if somebody put in your name that they would get your phone number, and so they'd say, I want to call John Smith, and it would get John Smith's phone number and dial and route your call to John Smith. Obviously, it's a little, it's different with the domain name stuff, and most people on the internet should understand how that one works. But you can see where if you can control where people go, you can disguise yourself as a site that you're not, and there's all kinds of openings to it's the equivalent of if you could steal somebody's phone, and then when someone calls them, they know they called that correct number, and they assume the person they're talking to is who they meant to talk to, and the next thing they know, they're sending $300,000 to a Nigerian prince or whatever. The latest thing is a bug, an ancient lurking bug in a critical software library called glibc. That is itself both ancient and widespread in its point of contact with software of all description. Apparently, the bug can be triggered by tricking a remote computer simply looking up a domain name. You know, that happens all the time. So that is not a, that's not a very high bar if you can just trigger it by getting a domain name lookup.
By quote unquote tricking it into looking up a domain name, I mean by asking it to look up a domain name. There's not a lot of trickery involved.
Right. It's very easy to do. Computers look up domain names all the time just to figure out which stuff to ignore as malware. Mail servers look up senders' domains to decide whether they're spoofed. Spam filters look up domains inside messages. Print servers look up domains to figure out if requests are coming from an authorized machine. So it's a bug that potentially yields full control over another computer, and you can trigger it by forcing or tricking that computer into looking up a domain name. Kaminsky drills into some details about how grave this is. Then it gets really interesting because although there's a patch for the bug, the thing that makes the bug possible is getting worse, not better, according to Kaminsky. Quote, he says, "It is unlikely that this is the only platform threat or even the only threat in glibc. With the Internet of Things spreading extraordinarily, perhaps it's time to be less concerned about being able to spy on every last phone call and more concerned about how we can make sure innovators have better environments to build upon. I'm not merely talking about the rather, quote, frothy, unquote, software stacks adorning the Internet of Things with Bluetooth and custom TCP IP and so on. I'm talking about maintainability. When we find problems, and we will, can we fix them? This is a problem that took Android too long to start seriously addressing, but they're not the only ones. A network where devices eventually become existential threats is a network that eventually ceases to exist. What do we do for platforms to guarantee that attack windows close? What do we do for consumers and purchasing agents so they can differentiate that which has a maintenance warranty and that which does not?" You know, he's making the same basic point, which is that, you know, this is all built stacked on stacked, you know, an archaeology site, all these layers. And when there's a vulnerability in a layer that's deep that everybody uses, there's a bunch of stuff that happens on your computer that is at layers that you don't even think about. I mean, you know, obviously most people are focused on, they move the little arrow around and point at stuff and it works. But there's all kinds of things underneath. When your computer does tasks, it uses code that's been around for a long time. And what we're finding, you know, some of this, I guess, you know, I don't know whose role it should be. Should it be, is it business? Is it government? Should somebody be going back through all this stuff? I mean, do we really need to refactor just about everything? And can we afford to? You know, I Barrett and I, and you know, work with software directly, and the problem is that some of this stuff is at a much deeper level than we get to. You know, we're writing stuff that floats on the surface of these servers and of this the core system software. And if you can compromise it there, then you're basically deeper in the machine than we are.
Everything topples,
and it all comes down. So it's sort of a I don't know. It's one of those where you kind of go, is Apple on the right track maybe with this sort of more secure approach to operating systems, where, you know, I wonder, would that result in a more, you know, a less exploitable thing?
Hey, let's just blame it on the hardware, guys. It's a hardware problem. Software's fine.
Well, we're getting real close to where, you know, some of these bugs that are in DNS from 1983, I guarantee you some of the guys that caused them, certainly they didn't do it on purpose. They probably have died of old age. So there's nobody to even look back to figure out what happened or why or any of that.
As a developer, you don't want to die with unsquashed bugs. I think that's bad.
And I also don't think the NSA should be the ones that pony up. I think they would be a good place to start, because they should be looking at how they put software on their machines that they can count on.
Or even just getting the back doors in. You're like, hey guys, here's a brand new DNS system. You know, never mind the back door. I think at this point we would take it because ours is so broken, you know?
Maybe. But you just wonder how You wonder how far this is going to go. I mean, how deep do the how old do the bugs get, and how you know, when it's critical basic software libraries, what do you, you know, how do you make sure that that's fixed with that? Because imagine, you know, just to back up, because everybody, you know, everybody thinks about it, it's like, oh, well, my Word isn't working right. Oh, well, install the latest update. Okay, now it works. But if you're talking about a core level software and you fix it and you introduce a new bug, then what happens?
Please wait while we upgrade the internet.
So it the complexity, it's all these simple, you know, well, it's actually, instead of it being a bunch of simple pieces put together to make something crazy complex, it's a bunch of complex pieces put together to make something that is crazy complex.
Well, it's not, it goes way, way beyond updating, you know, software on workstations too. You would have to update the software on things that are really not all that updatable, you know, routers, you know, that might need more than a firmware upgrade, all kinds of embedded devices, all kinds of edge devices, you know, just about everything. It's not just computers and the switches, you know, and a few different telcos. It's everything. So it's a pretty big undertaking. I don't think it can happen, you know, overnight. How long has it taken us, Pete, for IPv6? We're still not really yeah. quite there.
Well, now we'll have even more addresses to hook insecure machines up to our insecure network. It's sort of boggling, and the problem is when it's boggling to the people who are interested in it, then it's really hard to get regular people to understand. And because right now I think basically we go along in the fact that it works, even though there's, you know, 80% of the mail out there is spam. As long as we're still getting that 20% that we are wanting, it's okay. We'll allow it. But I, you know, I don't. I wish I had like some, you know, simple and glib answer, but it seems like I'm almost surprised that somebody like Google or even Apple or one of those, it's like go back to square one and pony up to build something that, where you've checked out every piece of it as you add it and tested it really far enough that people can find it. Because see, the users, part of the thing I think with this is that people are getting more sophisticated. You know, the people who understand this stuff, because, you know, a lot of them start as script kiddies, but I think that gives you kind of a lot of them just stop there. But by doing that stuff, they get insights into where the vulnerabilities are. And it's almost, in some of them, it's almost intuitive.
That's what's always kind of gotten me. We bump into a lot of people at DEF CON and places that can almost immediately, you know, look into a program or find, you know, something, a way to compromise it, but they're not developers. They can't write code, but, you know, they can get a decompiler and look where the loops are and just kind of intuitively know where to go. Not quite like savant level, but it's just weird. So I think it is something that just can be learned through repetition or just, you know, just overdoing it. And seeing all the patterns and it finally clicking. But that's always impressed me. I can't do that.
Yeah, really.
And I write it, so yeah.
Yeah, I guess we're relative to that, we're more the like bricklayers of...
Well, we build things. We don't break things as much. There's definitely two sides to everything.
Well, if you're bumping into people at DEF CON, you got to be careful because it mm-hmm. could be like a ruse.
They could be picking your pocket.
Well, digitally.
Yeah.
When does Mr. Robot start again? Do you have that for us, Pete?
It's already been on.
Oh, season two?
Yeah, we're 5 episodes in.
Jeez, it got no butt.
ruse. Taken by the internet.
What a gullible. Wow. Should have Googled it first.
I looked at Flicked and yeah.
the Liatron.
I started to say something and I was like, oh, he's trolling. So I backed off and didn't say anything. And then Barrett looked at me like, is this true? And I tried to have kind of a flat face, but I was already smiling. So.
I was about to get no sleep tonight. That's good. That's good that it hasn't come back yet. Okay.
It's not coming back.
No, come on now. That's just me now. Internet bullying. In real life.
I'm sorry that the radio show is no longer your safe space.
Oh, all right. Well, and the sort of final news story before that probably gets us to the top of the hour. This one, I didn't know about this, but apparently now they've decided, Microsoft has decided that it's time to monetize the lock screen with more than 200 million systems running Windows 10. a lot of them got that, got the upgrade for free. Over the past few days, now suddenly, Windows 10 users have reported having their lock screens taken over by advertisements for Rise of the Tomb Raider. Microsoft started selling the game through the Windows Store last month in what might be the start of a much bigger push into PC gaming. They hadn't hit its intentions to use the Windows 10 lock screen as a commercial billboard, having first discussed its plans during last year's Build Developers Conference. Although, I don't recall stumbling across anything that mentioned it. It didn't seem to come up in the whole run up to with Windows 10 coming out. But now Microsoft appears to be making good on those promises, with Howdy Geek's Chris Stobing and at least one Reddit user having seen Rise of the Tomb Raider ads themselves. Now, you can disable it. Although here's the deal. To disable it in Windows 10, you head to Settings, Personalization, Lock Screen, and uncheck the box that reads, "Get fun facts, tips, tricks, and more on your lock screen."
I don't want to have fun.
Notice it doesn't say anything about, "We want to advertise at you." Keep in mind, the option to disable the ads only shows up if you've selected picture or slideshow under the background section of lock screen settings.
But it was a fun fact that they were releasing this video game.
If you're using Windows Spotlight, which routinely refreshes the lock screen with images from Bing, ads are presumably part of the deal. In other words, you chose it and it's going to show you that. The lock screen is one of several ways that Windows 10 isn't exactly free, from start menu promotions to subscription-based games to personalized ads in Bing and the Edge browser. Microsoft has plenty of money-making hooks built into its latest OS. Most of these can be avoided or disabled, including the new lock screen promos. But with hundreds of millions of users upgrading to Windows 10, whether they intended to or not, Microsoft is banking on the notion that most people won't be so proactive. On the plus side, Apple didn't, when they give their OS away for free, they aren't sticking ads on the screens.
All right. Well, there's the sound that tells us that Mr. Robot will never be seen again.
What?
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break here because it's the top of the hour. We have to take a short break to take care of station business.
Stay tuned for these fun facts.
Fun facts. You're listening to Technology Bytes. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
And he's
Barrett.
Barrett.
On Saturday, April 16th, join San Jose Clinic for a night of fun, philanthropy, and auctions of art and jewelry at Art with Heart, their annual fundraising gala. This year, they will be honoring United Way of Greater Houston with the Portrait of Compassion. This event supports the clinic's 94-year legacy of providing health care for the underserved. For more information, call 713-490-2620. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org, worldwide. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at KPFT Houston.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you've got a ringtone for everyone.
I've got one for my best friend, my parents, work, and one for almost everyone.
Go, go.
Oh, sorry.
I wonder what a ringtone for KPFT would sound like.
Maybe it would sound like this.
Recent congressional actions have put the federal funding of community radio stations at risk, including KPFT.
That used to be money dedicated to the public good, but with public funding being politicized, many community media outlets could be silenced.
That's why KPFT depends on you, now more than ever, for its financial future. Over 90% of our funding comes from you.
If you haven't renewed your pledge, or if you have never made a pledge, you can visit kpft.org now to support this station.
Once again, that's kpft.org to pledge your support. You are listening to KPFT Houston.
We now return to Technology Bites.
And we're back. Yay.
For a half second there, I thought someone had done a new intro for us. But no.
No?
It's just station announcement. It kind of sounded like we were capable of that, the lead-in, you know, until it wasn't us.
All right, so.
Came back.
What's that?
Was that on purpose? Did Flick do that on purpose so that it sounded like we were introing something?
I don't know why he stuck the station ID in between promos, but people listening to the podcast will have no idea what we're talking about, so let's move on. All right.
Okay.
So it's the second hour.
Just mixing it up.
Yeah, I know. Keeping it real. Represent.
I'm mixing it up. Do we have a...
We don't have a Barrett time.
No.
There's currently...
See, that's why I have to mix it up.
You know, in the last couple of years, there have been more Mr. Robots than Barrett Times.
What? Troll. That'd be so awesome. That I don't think
there
that's
is true.
It could be true.
It's way true. How many Barrett Times have there been in the last couple of years?
Couple years. Well, the last 2 weeks.
There's been like
not many.
Three.
Yeah.
Maybe four. We'll I think Mr. Robot had a season of 8 or 9.
Ten.
I will beat Mr. Robot back.
Well, first episode was 0, right? Okay, yes.
It was 0 to 9, so it was 10 episodes.
You're right. As always. So when you're going for Mr. Robot news, believe Flick did.
That's why I checked him. I fact checked him first.
Don't trust
me. Instinctually.
Yeah, I don't remember actually when it's supposed to.
Everything I
say
about Mr. Robot is a lie.
Now Jesus messed with my head.
I want to say it's supposed to be a summer release for the second season.
It is going to be the summer?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
And... Sam Ismail is directing all the episodes himself.
Okay. Really?
He's a showrunner, writer, and directing this season, all of them.
We're going to have plenty of Mr. Robot fun coming up in August.
Yes. Actual Mr. Robot.
Yes. Just pick any random DEF CON attendee and delve into his neurosis, and you'll have a private screening of your own Mr. Robot.
There you go. Well, I guess we will go to this segment.
All right, that segment.
Fight.
La la la.
So this is a new thing, or an old thing coming back, and obviously you'll understand a little better in a second. Siri is supposedly or is rumored to be making its long-anticipated debut on the Mac in OS 10.12 later this year, following over 3 years of testing, according to 9to5 Mac. The report claims Siri will have an icon in the OS 10 menu bar, and users will also be able to set a keyboard shortcut and configure other settings through system preferences. When the Mac is connected to power, users will be able to make Hey Siri voice commands akin to the latest iPhones and iPads. Siri is expected to be one of the headline features of OS 10.12, codenamed Fuji, alongside other minor user interface tweaks. The changes will allegedly not be as significant as OS 10 Yosemite was in 2014. Siri came out on the iPhone 4S in 2011 and has since expanded to iPod Touch, Apple TV, and Apple Watch. The virtual assistant can be used to make web searches, launch apps, look up sports scores, play music, check the weather, set calendar appointments, and more. You know, Apple had voice command back in the very early 90s. It was obviously so successful that nobody remembers it. But yeah, they had that, and so now they're sort of circling back, except of course. Siri is a lot more sophisticated. You know, I wonder, are people going to, I wonder how much are people going to use it? You know, I guess Barrett, you use Alexa. Is that something that's been expanding how much you use it, or is it kind of leveled off?
No, actually, the two things, I do a lot of like, Alexa, what time is it? Which is kind of nice because it saves just a couple seconds, you know, having to go look at like the thermostat or something like that. And then a little bit of like, Alexa, you know, what's the weather outside just the past few days, because you don't know if it's going to be 80 or 40. and a little bit of music every once in a while. Like, you know, in the mornings when I get up, you know, just play something just to kind of, you know, keep going. So that's the nicest things. But I don't use it for shopping lists for a lot of the things that it could be used for. Mainly, you know, time, weather, and every once in a while an alarm.
Alexa, when's Mr. Robot coming back?
Never. Don't trust Jay Lee, Barrett.
Jay Lee tells us it's never coming back.
He's showing so much credibility this show. I used to, you know.
Alexa's, is Barrett in the room right now?
So, yeah, I don't know. I wonder. I guess one of the things, maybe as they put it on more and more devices, you'll use it. The thing to me is I've tried Siri. I'll do it to, like, make phone calls. You know, where you hold down the button on your Bluetooth and then it beeps and you hear the kind of tone for Siri and you can say, you know, call so-and-so and it'll do it. But whenever it's been more critical where you like get a text and you're in the car and you're kind of expecting something from somebody, getting it to where you can like hear the latest text and reply and some of that stuff has been, or the worst one is when you're in the car and you're trying to have an address looked up to get directions without like pulling over and, you know, punching in the address yourself. That seems to not go well for me with Siri. So I've limited how I use it. I don't know. I haven't run into anybody who like really deeply uses it. So you kind of wonder how many people are, you know, beyond, you know, hey Siri, call Bob kind of thing. How much people are really using it.
I wonder how much just the always on creeps out people, or if people really realize that, you know, it's listening to every single thing and it's throwing away, supposedly it's throwing away most of it just until it hears those keywords to activate and then it actually acts on whatever you say next. But in reality, it's listening the entire time.
Well, it's, but that's only when it's connected to power. It has to be plugged in. That's, which is sort of, you know, kind of, it messes things up because of course, if your phone, you don't want to plug that in. You know, for me, it's like, first off, I want it, you know, in my pocket, or I want it where I can grab it and go, and I don't want to have to unplug it. And second, I don't want to be plugging it in all the time where I'm messing with the, you know, I'm ruining the battery cycles.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking, like, if you're just, like, at work or you're in front of your computer during a normal day, are you going to leave, you know, your mic on for the OS 10.12 menu bar with Siri down there?
It looks like Biffing. Yeah. Well, sorry.
That's all right.
Siri, is Pete tired?
yeah, sorry. No, I think you have to choose to turn that on to make the Hey Siri thing work. Otherwise, it's a keyboard shortcut or a click in the toolbar at the top of the screen. So, you know, I think most people are probably going to go with the like click a button or do something where you tell Siri you want, just like on your phone where you hold down the button until it beeps to use Siri. And other stuff, there's some design drawings on the iPhone 5 SE. And what do you, you know, what could it look like? Is it going to be, I don't know, bat shaped? Is it going to have, you know, is it going to be thin as a piece of glass or is it going to look almost exactly like an iPhone 5S? I'll let you decide. But no, the rumors are that it's going to pretty much look like the iPhone 5S. Same physical dimensions. In 9to5 Mac did a rendering that they created from information they got from a case maker. Because, of course, that kind of information has to get out early enough where the case makers can construct. And so they know where the speakers are and they know where the button is and they know the kind of general, you know, the general where the screen, you know, the how big the bezels are and all that. So As for rumors of an iPhone 6-style curved cover glass, the iPhone 5SE is said to have a display that curves slightly at the edges, but it's not as dramatic on the new as on the newer devices. So that we'll know more about that in March. And so apparently from a distance, it will be visually indistinguishable. It'll be silver, space gray, rose gold, and gold, just like the iPhone 5S. So it's kind of a, I don't know what else is really that different. Now, maybe that the insides are different. It may have a better processor and some of that stuff, but it sounds like it's just the 5S in a new package, which is the only way to do the smaller screen, I guess.
Have they gotten completely away from going in succession of numbers? Is it just going to be, is the number going to be tied to, I guess, you know, the relative dimension of the screen? Because it's, they're kind of taking a step back. It'd always been, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Then we kind of go back, you know, 5.
Yeah, good question. It's, well, I think maybe it's that, you know, just like they do where there was the iPhone 6, and then when they increase the hardware and all that, but don't really change much else, then it's the 6S.
So they've never stepped back one, have they? Is this the first time they've kind of come down a number?
Yeah, yeah. But it's the 5SE, so I'm guessing if they I'm guessing if they upgrade it even further, it'll be the 5SEX, maybe? Experimental or extreme? Or
extreme.
5SEX. 5EX. It's not really a surprise. I mean, basically, it sounds like it's a value. It sounds like it's a value phone, and that they probably. I wonder if they looked at, you know, doing an iPhone 6 type design and do the smaller screen, and figured out that it's not different enough to take all that effort. You know, when they could spend more time on the iPhone 7 or whatever. At some point, you wonder what happens when it slows down. You know, the processors are getting good enough. You know, it's getting like laptops and a lot of desktops where they work good well enough for quite a while. So I guess we'll see what happens on we'll see. You know, I don't know. I mean, like you said, I mean, it's sort of a bargain thing. I think if Apple wasn't doing it, nobody'd care. Hey, I'm releasing a phone that's kind of like one from 4 years ago or 3 years ago, but it's going to have a couple of hardware tweaks. It's like, yawn. And if you have been affected, if you bricked your phone by doing the January 1, 1970 thing, even though everybody said don't do that, except the guy who told you that Mr. Robot was canceled. Now, the most recent beta of iOS 9.3 provided to developers and public beta testers earlier this week fixes the bug that caused 64-bit iPhones and iPads to be disabled or bricked when the date was set to January 1, 1970. They discovered the bug in mid-February. It occurs whenever an iOS device's date is manually set to 1970, resulting in a continuous reboot cycle. Speculation has suggested the reboot loop is a result of an integer underflow that causes the phone to reset the date to the maximum value, a huge number that iOS devices may be unable to process. With iOS 9.3 Beta 4, the date on the phone or iPad can't be set beyond December 31st, 2000 at 7 p.m. Eastern time, which equates to 1101 at 12 a.m. GMT, which effectively puts an end to the 1970 bug because obviously it's later. It's 20. Which, of course, why is there a reason to set your phone back to that kind of date anyway? So it's sort of not a surprise that the solution to, oh, hey, if I do this to my phone, it breaks it, is like, don't, well, we'll make this where you can't do that to your phone anymore.
I think they're trying to, I guess, get around the fact that if someone got time travel abilities and went back with an Apple phone, they couldn't actually do anything with it. That was kind of my plan. I was going to grab a smartphone, go back in time.
They've just
rich.
You
guys up with me, of course, but you know.
You know, I remember 1970, and I don't really think there's really any reason why one would want to time travel to there. You know, there's more interesting dates more recently and further back, but 1970 didn't seem to be particularly. Yeah, you can't be going back for the fashion. I know that.
Super quick segue. There is a new, I think it's a Stephen King kind of thriller, and he's, is it I don't think it's Abrams, but it's someone kind of equally cool. And they're going back to, I believe, 1964, or the JFK assassination. So it kind of gets into some conspiracy theory kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's what is it? It's
11. What's the date?
Yeah, because it's at, and isn't that sad?
I wasn't born yet, so that's my excuse on that. I don't remember where I was because I wasn't.
The only one of us that should be embarrassed is Jay, right? Because he would have been.
Ow.
Well,
quick Google,
secret,
quick.
11/22/63. Alexa, what? November 22nd.
Yes.
1963. Yeah. So it's, I think that it's like 11/22/1963 or something is the name of the show with James Franco. Mm-hmm. So maybe it'll get off the rails and get all weird. But so the real headline should be Apple putting block in time travel at 2001.
Grr. All right, so, different plans now.
now you're not going to be able to go back and see the Beatles on the roof of the whatever.
I'm never going to be able to invent Yahoo. Or ever make enough money to buy Yahoo. Yeah.
Yeah, let's move on to that segmento.
In the geek world, we hear about new gadgets and gizmos every day. But can they stand a dip in the snark tank?
Did AOL just slip out of your grip? You could have gotten that. Of course, now you probably still could buy it. It's probably pretty cheap. But now Yahoo is putting itself up for sale officially. The company has recently formed a review committee of independent directors to find, quote, strategic alternatives, unquote. Or, in other words, bankers and lawyers have been brought on board to find viable buyers of Yahoo.
Can't they just put it on eBay?
Yahoo Marketplace.
Ah, sorry. Well, that's why Yahoo's failing. It's the first go-to is eBay.
Could they sell it on their own? There you go. That the bids would be probably lower. Yahoo's not had a great time of late, and it's been cutting down on its expenditures. Now, here's the tough part with these kinds of things: is Yahoo does have things that there are people who I know kind of depend on, and so things that happen at Yahoo do have an effect, just not, you know, not usually your startup page or people who are still using Yahoo Mail, which I don't know why one would do that. Flickr's role has been diminished, plus many of the content verticals have been chopped down or abandoned altogether. Yahoo cut down 15% of its workforce recently and is, you know, of course, up for sale. It is a powerful enough web entity, especially in terms of its curated homepage content and email services, and it owns some decent platforms on the internet, including Tumblr. I'm sure a lot of the hip Tumblr kids would be shocked to realize that Yahoo is their, you know, that's like if your grandpa owned the like really awesome rave club you were going to. Of course, probably kids don't do that anymore either, so now I sound like a grandpa. Yahoo also owns a great share in Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba, so you could use the investment in Yahoo to get into offshore stuff in China, but... So it's interesting. I mean, I'm not really shocked. I kind of wondered what the limits of a index of a manual index of the internet were going to be once the first search engines were useful. So you know, they did buy a lot of other stuff and they stretched it out. So they certainly milked their 15 minutes for 20 years. Who else has done that?
Mr. Robot,
we're not flailing. Fortunately, we're not flailing and failing along.
We're going to sell this show for a profit every fundraiser.
There you go. So another interesting stuff. This one, you know, I wonder how it would work in practice is kind of the real question. It's called passive Wi-Fi. You know, one of the biggest energy hogs on your phone and, you know, portable devices is the juice to power the Wi-Fi or the 3G radio to send and receive data. Because, you know, they're essentially doing, you know, burning power even when you're not really getting more data. Researchers at the University of Washington are calling it passive Wi-Fi. And they said it slashes the power used by 802.11b transmissions to just 59 microwatts, which, since none of us know how much power your regular Wi-Fi uses, it's about 10,000 times less than a regular Wi-Fi chip would consume. A spinoff called Jiva Wireless has been formed with the intention of commercializing the so-called backscatter technology. Is this going to mean that people will be able to see what you look like under your clothes with their passive Wi-Fi?
Sneaky DHS.
It's got to be different backscatter. Here's how it works. Imagine Wi-Fi is a flashlight of sorts, beaming data back and forth. Your router has a flashlight pointed at your phone, and your phone has one as well. Passive Wi-Fi eliminates one of the flashlights and replaces it with a mirror. Your router still uses its existing Wi-Fi signal to send data to your mobile device. It's just that the passive Wi-Fi technology simply reflects it back. The stream of reflected, backscattered, off and on signals transmits the data at up to 802.11b speeds. So that's 11 megabits per second. So you're not going to be getting gigabit speeds. Researchers say they've been able to transmit this data between 30 and 100 feet using both line of sight and through wall scenarios. It's kind of clever because, of course, the power is coming from the router, which is plugged into the wall, and the reflected signals take less energy to create than the full on broadcast. So there's another scenario. So there's the whole get your battery to go farther. Unfortunately, it will probably require new hardware, both for routers and mobile devices. And then the other scenario is passive Wi-Fi could emerge as an ultra low power alternative to Bluetooth, whose low energy derivative consumes power in the hundredths of watts rather than the millionths of watts that passive Wi-Fi requires. So it could be an ideal solution for the Internet of Things. So it's an interesting the thing with this that kind of is intriguing to me is the idea. Who would have thought that the idea of not having active listening and broadcasting on a device would make sense for connecting up to Wi-Fi? You know, that's really clever, I think. And so it basically sort of chops up the signal that it's sending back, and by how it's been distorted or changed, lets the router know what you want.
So it's cool for me to go ahead and cancel that Yahoo Marketplace order of 10,000 batteries. Yeah.
Well, you just wonder. Well, although the only other thing with it is then you have to have a router though. Because you can't push stuff at the router.
There won't be like an ad hoc mode. You'll have to have that infrastructure there for this to work.
Yeah, because one of the things they say that with passive Wi-Fi, it means the passive sensor can't call for attention or signal the router that it's ready to transmit data. Instead, the routers will have to order the passive Wi-Fi devices to send data at a given time, which is not a huge deal, but there would be some latency that comes with that, because obviously it has to kind of see that. That's where I wonder. You wonder how that works. I guess there's some interesting questions with that, because think about it. So you got a room full of people with passive devices and a router. If there's 50 people in the room, how does a router, you know, how does it know who's really there? I mean, every so often is it sending out a like, hey, what's up? kind of signal, and then seeing what it gets back. It seems like the router has to keep a lot more track of what's going on. I don't know how that one will play out, but we can can certainly watch. And for some devices, if it's passive like that, it's one place where a passive thing might make sense would be instead of as a different way to do the tags, the ones like they're talking about for putting on products where you wouldn't have to have a cash register, where it just RFID.
Yeah. And that's kind of what those are. Those are kind of like passive radio devices for the most part. You bounce a little bit of energy off them and they radiate, you know, a certain code back or a certain frequency back.
So you wonder if maybe that's the, the answer, you know, maybe that's where they figured out the question.
It's okay. I think all the things you've kind of mentioned tonight, they're all going to line up in a few years to give this whole Internet of Things, you know, Internet of Things movement a second kind of boon and really just kind of accelerate things. Because we're there. We're getting, you know, all the rudimentary pieces. But, you know, you combine super low power networking with, you know, some secure DNS and some protocols, and this stuff is ready to take off.
Either that or we all adopt it, and then it turns out that some, like, you know, line 3 of the first program ever written has a bug in it that lets you just destroy it all.
Poof.
So what do you think of, you know, if we posted this, our discussion on Facebook, you know, basically your choice is you can like it or I guess you can block it. apparently now Facebook is rolling out reactions, which is like the like button with more stuff. I don't know if you guys have seen this, what they're offering.
Mm-mm. Are you apparently, trolling?
No. Is this real? It's real. It's as real as the cast changes on Mr. Robot.
What?
No. So they've gone from, you know, before you could just like. Now they don't have like hate and, you know, dislike and that kind of stuff, but they've added the love button. So you love it. The ha-ha. Basically, it's kind of emoji-like, but there's 6 of them. So there's
Is
like,
there slap with the trout?
Like, love, ha-ha, wow, sad. Sad might be effective. And angry. So I don't know. It seems like there's more reactions that people could have to I was hoping for the WTF emoji that they could come up with that so that you could, or awe. That would be another good one. Awe, A-W-W-W. So that when the people who share the, you know, like sleeping puppy and toddler videos or whatever, that you could use that. But now I'll just put angry. I'll just figure people will understand what I mean.
Make Facebook great again.
So yeah, you wonder what happens with that. I guess sad covers a lot of scenarios, because I don't know if you've had the experience where somebody's like, you know, oh, my beloved pet has died, he's succumbed or whatever, and you kind of go, well, I want to show my support, but I don't really know this animal, and I don't really have anything to add to the conversation, so. You know, you tap like. I think people understand that you're not saying, hey, really glad that, you know, little Sparky is gone.
It needs to just be an acknowledge button. That's all. You know, we don't need 6. Just acknowledge. That's it.
Oh, so we need just sin ack?
Yeah, just that's, we're overcomplicating this, I think. And we don't even need, like, other comments. They hit sin, we hit ack. Everyone gets their emotional connection fill. You're done. No politics, no sports, no cats.
Synac book. We might have our product. This may be. This could become huge, and we could leverage our funding and buy Yahoo.
Yes,
I exist. I approve of your existence.
And then our time machine. But then we're still stuck with the phone. So, one step at a time.
I don't know how that. I don't know if it's rolled out to everybody, but it's been launched. So perhaps you're going to see more reactions. The paradox one is would be the ignore reaction, because if you click that you ignore it, you didn't really ignore it. I guess that's why they didn't do that one. So and I realize as I went through the stuff, the story where I had the where I had the Facebook stuff. For some reason, there's a problem with the URL on that, and so I'll fix that after the shoe. And here, you know, if it's just been too difficult to buy a, you know, $20 or $30 Chromecast to add to your TV, you know, to get that kind of streaming video thing for your stuff, now Google and Vizio have revolutionized it by putting Chromecast directly into a new line of TV sets, so that you don't have to have that inconvenient Chromecast for $20. You can buy a $1,000 television set instead. Vizio is reportedly planning to release these new sets very soon. What's weird is that Google has a smart TV platform, Android TV, but these Vizio TV sets would be free of any on-set apps and would instead rely on the baked-in Chromecast features for its smarts. So that could be good. You know, basically it depends on how you like your smart TV. If you like it kind of stream at it, then that's one thing. And if you want it to do more stuff, then this would not be the answer. So I don't know. I wonder if it's not going to be a feature that people buy a bunch of TV, you know, people buy their TV and then find out that it's there, as opposed to seeking out a TV that does it.
Well, when I bought my TV, you know, it had a lot of smart built into it, you know, the ability to run apps and Netflix and all of that stuff built into the TV, but it was so minimalistic, it's so basic, it's slow to install apps, it's slow to run them, it's slow to switch over to them, and now with everything coming in, like either a Chromecast or a Fire Stick, or, you know, even DVD players and Blu-ray players come with that kind of capability built into them now, I'm thinking I'd rather unbundle my smart.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. How often do you change your screen, you know, the big hardware piece, and how often do you change the applications and what you run on it?
Right.
I think that, you know, having two separate pieces is the way to go.
They still need to come up with the one piece that allows you to pull it, all the content in from everywhere.
That's my biggest issue, not to keep going back to, you know, things like Siri and Amazon's Alexa and things like that, but I really wish there was, you know, like a one... I'll buy whatever device you want to, but I'd like it to be able to pull from all my different accounts and not have to go to, you know, for my Amazon content, I have to use, you know, Alexa. For my Google content, I've got to say, okay, Google. You know,
well, I
Apple
hadn't even
stuff,
thought about that as
Apple.
Another component to the whole, you know, consolidation
really nice.
Of media.
Yeah, if they could just all get in there, because it's like, I'll happily buy media from all of them.
Oh, that would be cool if you could say to your phone and say, okay, I need the answer to blah, blah, blah. I'm Siri, I have this answer. I'm Alexa, I have this answer. Okay.
Hide it out. Alexa's
okay,
like, no, Siri's wrong.
Oh, come on, don't listen to him. This is Jay Lee, and I'd just like to let you know that Mr. Robot still canceled.
What?
Hey,
Butthead.
Yeah, I wonder. I guess part of the deal, I think the deal with the phrase where you say the key phrase must be that they found a way where they can recognize most voices saying that phrase and can kind of hard code that into the device so that it knows it's there.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of narrows it. So the sad part about that is then you can't customize it. So you can't do the, you know, hey, butthead or whatever for your device. I do have on, you know, talking about getting all your content from the same source. It's not a try by or fry thing, or maybe it is a try thing. I wondered about, we can do a bit of show business and not like the Oscars opening or something. We got an email. Or I got an email offering an interview with somebody about the set top box thing, the opening up the cable boxes to competition. And this person, this organization, I won't list who they are, but this organization essentially is on the opposite side of it. And what they're claiming in their press release is that this is cronyism, that the FCC unlocked set-top boxes to give Google a monopoly.
Well,
I'm wondering if we should have someone on from this to kind of see what they say, because I think that it might be interesting to hear what their point of view is, but it seems to me like this is like a giant you know, AstroTurf organization trying to push on something that, I don't know, I don't see a downside to opening up cable boxes. I think I can see cable companies not liking it.
Well, not if they're going to, yeah, if they're going to cry cronyism and anti-competitiveness, that's exactly what we are now with the lockdown set-top boxes, I thought.
You don't get to decide. Hmm. You pay, they tell you if you want this service, you're going to pay X dollars a month for this box. So, you know, I don't know. I guess I'll email out and we can see if people are interested in this.
I bet the Bells are still upset about that too, because, you know, back when they had the lock on the phones, you had to rent your phone from them. And that went away, and now it's not that.
Yeah, I remember that transition. That was really weird. The you couldn't, if you wanted to buy a phone, it was crazy expensive. It was like a couple hundred bucks or something for a, you know, those phones were built like battleships. But I think the thing that killed it was these little like $5 phones that were like all one piece.
The Conair really phones?
Crappy Conair phones. Yeah.
Yeah, I actually still have a couple of the old like Bell handsets with a rotary dial.
Oh man.
Yeah.
My family never had the rotary dial. I knew people who had rotary dials, but we were all cutting edge technology where it was the boop beep boop boop beep boop boop.
My grandparents had rotary dial and party lines to where you could pick up and have to listen to see if someone else was on the phone.
I was on a party line one summer when I lived in my grandparents'
house. Not the fun kind.
No, it wasn't.
It was not a party. It wasn't a celebrating party.
I never actually had a party line like in my family's house, but that was rural, and it was cheaper to get a party line than to get a dedicated. So my dad just paid for a party line for the house. We didn't use the phone all that much anyway. But yeah, we also had 5-digit dialing when I grew up.
Hmm.
So you only had to dial
the
last letter of the prefix in the 4 digits. That's all.
So that's like the old, like when you watch like old I Love Lucy stuff and they give their phone number and it's like, usually it was a letter. So it's, I don't remember what they did for saying what the letters were, but it'd be like,
The Merriweather, they had different prefixes. I think that started out in New York and it would give you the first, you know, two or three numbers of the prefix.
I actually found a map. I don't know if I could find it again, but I found a map of Houston's original codes and it was the first two letters of whatever. And so like, I remember like in the downtown area somewhere, there was actually a section called Washington. So the first two digits would have been WA, whatever. But this was even, you didn't even have to say the name. Like where I was growing up, you didn't need the name, right? We only had one. So it didn't matter. There weren't more than one. Everybody in the entire city where I grew up, we wouldn't really call it a city, but you know, there was one prefix.
Or growing up.
that's
working
that's
on
true.
It. It's getting there.
So you didn't even need that. Like you didn't even have to do the Washington or Pennsylvania or Transylvania or any of that stuff. You just dialed 65000 and you got who you called.
Wow. But if you just dialed one, you got Alexander Graham Bell.
Graham Beaton.
That was back when you paid, well, for long distance, when you paid by the minute.
Oh, yeah.
And it that's one
super
I don't
expensive.
Miss.
Or those chat phone calls where you paid through the nose by the minute.
Oh, man, I hadn't thought about that in a long time. Remember, like, when Sprint was up and coming and, like, their whole big deal was they had better long-distance connectivity, you could hear a pin drop?
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't thought about that in forever, but...
Well, and when they had where it was the long distance plan, where it was all you could talk long distance for $50 a month or $80 a month or something, it's like on that, on the plus side, we don't have to, you know, we're paying, our cell phone bills maybe not as low as you would like them to be, but they aren't as bad as an old
long distance.
You know, if you made
plan.
A long distance call,
yeah,
I mean,
you would, back in the day, you would have to. You'd have to time it. Like, you know, you're going to call your grandparents or something.
Certain day of the week, certain time.
Yeah, and even before that, it didn't matter. It was always the same expensive price. You know, it'd just be like, hey, grandma, okay, I got to go. Or, you know, parents would come by like, you hang up. It's been 3 minutes. That's like, you know, $8.
Well, and when you were at your grandparents' side of the conversation, you could tell how far away someone was calling by how loud they would yell into the phone. We used to joke about that with my grandmother because we'd be over there and the phone would ring. She'd pick it up and, you know, hello in a normal voice. And then, oh, hi. And then it's like, oh, they're calling from Minnesota. On the final try by or fry thing is actually a piece of hardware that sounds kind of interesting. Marshall makes headphones, and they have a one called the Major 2, which is a Bluetooth wireless set of headphones. And the interesting part is on the box it says that they give you 30 hours of playback, and Gadget ran a review on it. And the 30 hours of playback is the like up to 30 hours, which means like downhill. And if you didn't listen, you know, if you listened to it so softly that you couldn't hear it or didn't turn it on, it would last however many hours the thing said. No, apparently this one goes even longer than they said. And the tester found that it went 37 hours at high volume on this Bluetooth headphone, which is about three times what you'd expect from most. It runs about $150, where its competitors that don't last as long are 20 to more than double the price. So, you know, that seems like for if you don't want to worry about if you keep getting burned by your Bluetooth headphones. Now, this is over the ear headphones. So if you're using them, that can be a feature or it can be a bug. You know, in like an open office, that seems like it would be a and it doesn't have active noise cancellation. But if you're in like a big open office, it means you could go for a lot of days without charging them up. And so that then you could and people could see them on your ears. So you wouldn't have to worry about them trying to talk to you while you're listening. And you could go, wait, the battery's almost out. At 8 o'clock in the morning, and then still be listening at 5 when you sneak out the door. So I don't know that it certainly I would certainly be interested in trying it, and I think with 37 hours of life, it might be worth a it could possibly be worth a buy. Oh, it's not released here yet. It'll be released in the U.S. in the next few weeks, so. There's that.
Going back to an earlier topic, I was reminded of a great tweet that I saw on the Twitters relating to the iPhone situation. It says, if the FBI needs to get into someone's iPhone without permission, they should just call U2 and ask how they did it.
That's probably the best the best one I've seen.
That's one of the best ones I've seen on the whole thing. So. Anyway, good for a laugh.
Oh, yeah. Well, good way to get Twitter is great to get snarky commentary on.
Although snarky Twitter tweets and sarcastic Facebook posts have done nothing to stall or slow down the Trump train.
True.
We've tried snarky comments. That doesn't seem to be working.
Well, I think the interest, you know, it's interesting to see how the different candidates use social media and how they fit. I mean, I think the Trump campaign and the Sanders campaign are really tied to social media, particularly tied to social media.
Somebody made a comment that I thought was very telling and accurate. I mean, regardless of what you think about Trump. Somebody compared him, you know, not necessarily him personally to Kennedy personally, but Kennedy capitalized on television and mass media, was one of the first presidential candidates to figure that out and said, okay. And he had a great television presence. One of the things that made him very successful in his campaign for president. And Trump is one of the first candidates to really leverage social media to his advantage in his campaign, and for good or for ill, he is using this tool to great effect.
Well, I think he's also using. He seems to me to be using trolling, massive trolling skills that were developed on the internet.
Well, the thing that makes him popular is the same thing that makes people feel empowered by making hateful YouTube comments. He is the YouTube comment section of American politics. It's just it's so horrifying to read and listen to that you can't look away. What were we going to say, Barrett? I cut you off.
No, I saw it. Trump said that Mr. Robot was canceled too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure that he would, as part of making America great again, he would
bring Mr. Robot back.
No, he'd kill all the hackers.
No. Oh.
No TV's promoting this criminal lifestyle either.
I'll be right back.
He's going to build a firewall, and he's going to make you pay for it.
We need to put a literal back door in every phone. There's going to be a little door on the back.
All right.
So, okay, well, there's this, the final. It's the final
segment. My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious
science.
So, this one, you know, this article is about, it says that Earth may be a 1 in 700 quintillion kind of place. And this is not BuzzFeed, so they're not exaggerating to be link baity. but the funny thing is the article doesn't say anything about the Fermi paradox in it, which you kind of would hope that they would address that. But basically, a new study suggests that there are around 700 quintillion planets in the universe, but only one like Earth. It's a revelation that's both beautiful and terrifying at the same time. Astrophysicist Erik Zachrisson from Uppsala University in Sweden, arrived at this staggering figure, a 7 followed by 20 zeros, with the aid of a computer model that simulated the universe's evolution following the Big Bang. His model combined information about known exoplanets with our understanding of the early universe and the laws of physics to recreate the past 13.8 billion years. Of course, the next most like us planet basically just has half a season less of The Simpsons.
Or Mr. Robot.
Yeah, Mr. Robot runs perpetually there on everything. No, he found that the Earth appears to have been dealt a fairly lucky hand. In a galaxy like the Milky Way, for example, most of the planets the model generated looked very different than Earth. They were larger, older, and very unlikely to support life. Of course, the issue is that there's the model. You know, it's a matter of, is his model correct? And it'll have to be compared to. His work suggests an alternative to the commonly held assumptions that planets similar to Earth must exist based on the sheer number of planets out there. Current estimates hold that there are some 100 billion galaxies in the universe containing about 10 to the 18th stars, or a billion trillion, for those of you keeping track at home. One of the most fundamental requirements for a planet to sustain life is, of course, the Goldilocks region, where it's, you know, not too warm and not too cold, where the temperature is just right and liquid water can exist. You know, one thing that I guess does indicate that this guy might be on the right track is apparently, astronomers have only found around 30 exoplanets that were in the habitable zones of stars. So, but that, you know, of course, we've only found 30. But if you extrapolate that based on the known number of stars, it suggests that there are 50 billion such planets in the Milky Way alone. So, the model says that most planets in the universe shouldn't look like Earth, and that we are a mild statistical anomaly in the multiplicity of planets. You know, again, one of the things I think this points out a thing in science, which is these models can tell you something and you can learn from them even when they're wrong. And I'm not saying this one's wrong. I'm not saying it's right. It's that the tough part is when it gets into, if it gets into regular media, when they draw extra conclusions from it, that aren't necessarily based on what the original study was, because somebody wanted a cool headline like Earth, we're all alone in the universe, or something like that. But it'll be interesting to see how his model holds up, and see what you know, the thing about it is, on any of these, if the model, you know, when we'll know it's wrong is when we find out it's wrong. You know, when we like look through the telescope and there's an Earth-like planet that, you know, has water and life on it or whatever that we end up seeing. So, but that one was kind of, that was interesting, weird science, you know, and again, it's a theory. This guy has a, or he has a model that produces a particular result. And so now the job of science is to find out, is that true or not? Or there's a, well, it would call for non-radio friendly language, so I won't say it, but there used to be I don't know how, I know Jay definitely watched it, In Search Of.
Oh yeah, with Leonard Nimoy.
Leonard Nimoy, where the in the 70s, where there was a, you know, primetime television show that was looking into Bigfoot, aliens, the Bermuda Triangle. They were, and of course they had to fill time for every show, so they were very, they were not going to debunk, you know, the problem with the, if you have a debunking show on those things is you have one season and then you've pretty well debunked everything.
I remember watching all of those shows when I was younger, you know, about the Loch Ness Monster or about Bigfoot, and it took a long time to realize that not one of these shows was ever going to definitively prove that they existed.
Yeah, but no answers, really.
And just show after show after show of the same footage, the same photographs, the same speculations and what ifs, and that's just too bad. Wish they would have eventually either proven or disproven any of them.
Well, a lot of the evidence, though, like Bigfoot, I don't know if you've seen it, but somebody, you know, with technology moving along like it has, the famous Bigfoot, you know, walking across the clearing video.
Yeah.
Somebody ran that through an image stabilizer, so that it's just like, so instead of being
no camera shake
thing, and it's a dude in a gorilla suit walking across a field. I mean, it's so obvious.
I'm just waiting for him to come up and say, "We have proof that the Loch Ness Monster doesn't exist. Here's his skeleton."
Here's where his skeleton should be. And do you see it? It's not there. You know, there's like impressions in
the lack
bottom
of photographic
of the lake.
Evidence proves the existence of UFOs. Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot. Or can you find that video of the Bigfoot field image? Bigfoot image stabilized. But yeah, that will bring it up.
Right.
Yep. Patterson footage stabilized. It's on YouTube. If you do Bigfoot stabilized, make sure the original footage. Yeah.
And it's just kind of, It's, I thought, you know, that changes, you know, it's one of those, think about all the time on circling back on these things. That's been the biggest thing that's ever, you know, that was the biggest source of evidence on Bigfoot. You know, whenever you went to, I remember in the 70s, there was a couple movies where there was like, there was a movie about Bigfoot, you know, the real story or whatever. And of course, the whole thing is them talking for a long, long time. And then, 2/3 of the way through, showing you the shaky cam footage of Bigfoot, of actual Bigfoot in motion, which, you know, it seems like that's, well, you know, now we have the new thing is what, you take a bunch of bozos and go out in a field and have them put on night vision goggles and be scared of random sound. Did you hear that click? You know, you hear a twig break or, you know, or else some kind of weird animal sound, which those I guess have the like paranormal ones have kind of peaked out, haven't they? They don't seem to be on as much.
I think it all started out with the Blair Witch Project when they stole the shaky cam footage from the Patterson film.
Well, it does, you know, it gives it a realism, and it is like it takes advantage of, you know, if you think about people's minds, they fill in the blanks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you see something that looks like, oh, it's some kind of creature I've never seen before, then, you know, that your brain will enhance the image to be clearly it's some kind of alien or some kind of, you know, one that wasn't, that they were not putting forth as something to, you know, to trick people. That there was that alien movie that M. Night Shyamalan did. What was it, Signs or something?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
If you remember seeing it, in the early part, there would be stuff they were doing. They were showing where people were getting minor bits of footage of the aliens. So you like only saw them for a second, or like the video's going and you could see in the background, like between two houses, you could see something walk across. And, you know, it was the same effect, which is that out of the corner of your eye, you see something move. And then by the time you look at it, you don't get a really good look, but it's like really catches your, you know, gets your curiosity up. And then the other science news, this one, SpaceX is going to try. They were going to do it today and they had to scrub it because of weather. But their deal is they're going to launch a commercial communications satellite to geostationary orbit, and then they're going to try to land it on the ship again. And the thing with this is, even before they're doing it, in the press kit, SpaceX says, given this mission's unique profile, a successful landing is not expected. And I think that's cool. Basically, instead of like trying to, we're going to nail it. Instead, it's like, no, this is the ultimate geek thing. We figure it's not going to work, but we're going to try and we'll see what happens. And so the deal is they're going to launch it into orbit, launch the satellite, and then come back to Earth and land it on an automated ship in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Florida. If they ever do it, it would be a historic first, landing an orbital rocket on a sea-based platform. So the press kit says, quote, the first stage of the Falcon 9 will attempt an experimental landing on the, of course I still love you, drone ship. The name of the ship is Of Course I Still Love You. I guess that's after it crashed into the ship a couple times. But I guess they'll webcast it tomorrow. All the previous tries have failed at sea, but the last attempt in January came very close. One of the rocket's four landing legs failed to lock out, even as the Falcon 9 booster made a feathery touchdown on the drone ship in high seas. So the other interesting part is the landing attempt is about 10 minutes after they launched the rocket, so it's not like a big long wait to see it. So will they crash through the ship like Bugs Bunny, or land soft as a feather, or will there be some other interesting and creative failure? Tune in and find out. So there's that.
There is that. And there's that.
And that's timing. Perfect show.
Oh, the perfect show. Thanks a lot, Groovehouse and Lee. All right, well, that music coming up from behind us is the sound of another show in the can. We're done. And happy to have been here tonight. I'm going to go outside where it's supposed to be cold. It's supposed to be getting pretty cold tonight, not a hard freeze or anything, but nice and cold. So enjoy that if you're in the Houston area. At least we're not where we're getting covered in snow.
Yeah, if you're listening in a place that's not been over freezing since January 12th, then sorry.
Yeah, we're sorry that we were wearing shorts when we got here and coats when we left. All right, well, this has been an episode of Technology Bites. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
And he's
Barrett
House.
Attention all KPFT members. Starting this month, everyone who donates to KPFT will get a KPFT foodie card. What's a foodie card? KPFT's charter restaurants will offer everyone carrying the KPFT foodie card discounts. The charter participants include Berry Hill and the Heights, the Burger Joint in Montrose, Ruggles Green, the East End Farmers Market, and more. Go to kpft.org for a full list of charter participants. Donate to KPFT and eat out for less.
Want to help KPFT but can't make the drive out to the Little House on Lovett Boulevard? A great way to aid KPFT is as simple as logging into Facebook and Twitter. Connect with KPFT via social media. It's simple. Just visit twitter.com/KPFT and facebook.com/KPFT Houston. Then share our links and donate form with your social circles on Twitter and Facebook. Chances are you know people who may not know KPFT, and you'll introduce them to the fantastic music, interviews, news, and more that you hear daily on this radio station. Remember, just visit twitter.com/KPFT or facebook.com/KPFT Houston to promote and support KPFT online. This is Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.